He said, you're gonna make love to me or I'm gonna kill you.
This is a really dangerous serial rapist who just happened to be good looking from a wealthy family.
A star athlete from an exclusive Connecticut town is accused of brutal crimes.
Every mother wanted their daughter to date this kid.
The media had a field day. Rich kid goes bad.
Pressure builds to put the suspect behind bars, but that's not what happens.
There was a sense there that his parents would do anything to protect him.
Where was he? Nobody knew.
It was extraordinary that a kid from the suburbs could elude the FBI and Interpol. You expect that from Jason Bourne, but not from somebody from Darien.
In depth, insightful, in a class of its own. It's America's leading journal, Vanity Fair. Jeanette Conant tells the shocking story of the fugitive son. Darien, Connecticut, a wealthy corporate haven 38 miles east of Manhattan.
Darien is sort of a sleepy, ritzy bedroom community. It has big homes with leafy lawns.
Darien was a very image-conscious community, charming named streets like Hummingbird Lane and Berry Point. On the outside, everything looked perfect. It was a community that didn't want to know anything bad about itself.
It's the winter school break. Adrian Back, a sophomore, has just turned 16.
It was a Friday night. It was February 10th. So it was 5 days after my birthday. I was excited because I get my license in Connecticut at 16. So I had been looking forward to getting a license.
She was happy and she, you know, had a nice family. Naive probably would be the best word to describe her. She just wasn't a kid that was out there, you know, running with the fast pack.
She was such a straight-laced girl from such a straight-laced, conservative Darien family.
She had attended a party in the south end of Darien that night after going to, I think, a basketball game.
My parents were strict. I had to be home at 11:30, and it was around 11:25, and I realized I needed to get a ride home.
She calls her father to tell him she's going to be late. One of the seniors, a popular star athlete, offers her a ride home.
The ride, it was awkward. When I tried to talk to him, I think it was a one-word answer back. And he just stared straight ahead. We got to my street and he wasn't slowing down. And he then said to me, do you want to go to my house and get stoned? And I said, no, just take me home. And that's my house. You're passing my house. Stop. And he just kept driving. He drove to a small lane that was off of my street with a dead end and woods. And he turned off the car, pulled the keys out, and locked the doors. It happened so fast. He was on top of me, straddling me, and his legs basically pinning me to the seat, and he's trying to kiss me. As soon as I pushed him away, his hand immediately went to my throat. I'm reaching for the door handle. I'm reaching to unlock the door, and I can't find anything. It's pitch black. He said, this could be easy or this could be hard. And you're gonna make love to me or I'm gonna kill you. I knew I was in trouble. And the next thing I knew, he told me to move into the back of the car. Now I'm sort of taking orders. I remember thinking at this point, I promised my sister I was gonna stay a virgin. As if I had some kind of control over it. He's sort of straddling me at this point, and there's no real moving around, and he forcibly now takes my pants off, and he proceeds to rape me violently, painfully. I start to scream, and he again, straight to the throat with his hand, and says, "If you make another noise, it's gonna be worse." As I started putting my clothes back on, I remember asking him, "Why did you do this to me? Why?" He said, "I just couldn't control myself." Ironically, you could have thrown a rock at my house from where this all happened. I mean, it was so close. He stopped at the end of the driveway. He told me at least 3 times. If I told anyone, he would do it again, and he would kill me. After I got out of the car and I closed the door, I immediately started to cry. So I'm bawling. I mean, I had held this in for a really long time, and it just came out. When my father opened the door, he knew something was wrong. My father said, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" I rushed right by him so fast he couldn't get a good look at me and went straight upstairs. I'm finally alone, and the pain of this is coming out. I can't believe this just happened. It was just overwhelming, you know? It was overwhelming. I was an innocent virgin when I left the house that night. And now I'm a victim and violated. He ended my life as I knew it.
Adrian's older sister, Kristen, overhears her crying and enters her room.
I was on the floor, sobbing, face down. I think I was just sort of rocking. And she said, "What happened to you?"
Adrian confesses to her sister that she has just been raped. Together, they tell their parents about the brutal attack.
They tried to convince me to go to the hospital. I did not want to go. I was so afraid. I was petrified. I remember saying to my mother, "What if he's watching? What if he sees me?" I mean, these were real fears to me. They were real. It wasn't until the next day that they were able to convince me that I really just needed to go get myself checked out medically. I agreed.
Adrian went to a gynecologist. She was really having trouble processing everything that was happening and was very reluctant to have any kind of internal exam or anything done.
We went right from the hospital to the police station, and I must have been there for 4 or 5 hours, maybe more.
Adrian meets with Rebecca Hahn Nathanson, a patrol officer with the Darien Police Department, and her partner.
Adrian Back was in very, very bad shape emotionally. In my whole career, probably the most fragile victim I ever dealt with. She was very tearful and emotional and just really unsure of, you know, how to proceed. She had marks still the next day on her neck, and she had some other abrasions. We did not photograph her injuries that night because we made a collective decision that doing that might be the straw that broke the camel's back.
I remember after I signed the statement that they really wanted me to move forward and press charges. I was afraid he'd find out. So when I left the police station, I wasn't planning on pressing charges at all.
Three days after Adrian Back said she was attacked, Officer Hahn and her partner are called to the emergency room at the Stanford Hospital. 17-year-old Hillary Tollett is in an exam room with her mother.
Hillary was a girl from the next town over, Stanford. She was very happy, engaged in her teenage life, a lot of friends, and she went to this party in Darien. Hillary went outside at the party to smoke a cigarette, and this guy was out there, and he said to her, oh, do you want to come sit in the car? It's cold outside. It's February. And she said, all right, I'll just sit in the car. You know, she said he looked like a nice guy, you know, didn't look dangerous.
And he took off without her permission. He just started driving.
And there was a back parking lot at this country club that was very isolated. He pulls back in that parking lot.
He jumped on her. He put his hand around her neck. He tells her to take her clothes off. She wouldn't do it. He threatened her, and he pushed her in the backseat. And she was aggressive enough to physically knee him. And he raped her.
He said, don't tell anybody, or I'll kill you.
Hillary Tollett just told police that she was raped by a young man she didn't know after he viciously attacked her in his car. He took her back to the party they attended earlier that evening. Hillary says she immediately called her mother and they went to the hospital.
Anytime someone comes in and says they've been sexually assaulted, there's an exam that they do with what's called a rape kit. She was very cooperative in photographing the injuries. She was very angry and wanted to do whatever we needed to do to get this guy.
It was the friendly guy who let her sit in his car to get out of the cold. The one who said his name is Alex Kelly.
When she identified Alex Kelly as the perpetrator, we all just kind of silently looked at each other.
Alex Kelly, a senior at Darien High School.
I would describe Alex as an all-American boy. Clean-faced, great big smile, very polite.
Alex Kelly was this incredibly talented athlete. He was king of the hill. All the kids that I had talked to really looked up to him.
Alex was an undefeated wrestler at 11-0 was his record. And so he was a force to be reckoned with.
Now that he's been accused of two rapes in just 3 days, police immediately go to apprehend Alex Kelly.
After the next rape occurred, I think that the officers were literally sick at heart when I spoke to them.
The police chief called and said he was coming up to see me. They were going to arrest Alex for rape. He was due to go to a wrestling match.
So we arrested him, put him in handcuffs, put him in the back of a car, and brought him into headquarters.
He had quite a lot of attitude. He immediately protested an innocence. He acted like this was a huge hassle.
He is asking us, is he going to get out in time to go and wrestle in his wrestling match? I remember the chief of police telling me that Alex Kelly had raped another girl. It was like someone just punched me in the throat. Had I pressed charges at that police station 3 days ago, this would have never happened to her. That's how I felt. So I felt like I had to press charges.
Alex Kelly is charged with 2 counts of forcible rape. He pleads not guilty. Joe and Melanie Kelly retain Michael Sherman, an ambitious Stanford lawyer, to defend their son.
Alex said he didn't commit these crimes. I gave 2 girls a ride home. They engaged in consensual sex with me on 2 different nights, and that's the end of story.
There was a lot of talk, because it was a small community, was that this was perhaps possibly date rape. At that time, that term was sort of used as a band-aid to sort of mean
oh, this was an athlete who had had a bit too much to drink, who went a bit too far. But it was unfortunate that boys will be boys and things got out of hand sort of implication.
That was a very prevalent feeling among the boys in Alex's peer group in the 80s, and a lot of it came from ignorance.
Alex Kelly was so good looking. He had a very attractive blonde girlfriend. Everybody knew who they were. Why would he do this? Darian was a bit in shock and a bit in denial that this could have happened.
Every mother wanted their daughter to date this kid. And all of a sudden, there's all these serious accusations. It literally split the town.
On the surface, Alex Kelly appears to be the golden boy. But this is not the first time he's been in trouble. Days before the start of school in 1983, his sophomore year, Alex embarked on a 9-month-long crime spree.
He did house burglaries on neighbors' houses. These were wealthy families. And he took a stereo, he took foreign currency, he took silverware.
And they would go down to the city, he and some of his friends would go down to the Diamond District and sell the silver for money and buy drugs and come back to Darien.
Alex and his cohorts are arrested on June 15th, 1984.
Alex was charged with 9 counts of larceny and 9 counts of burglary.
His parents hire a well-connected local lawyer.
The judge reduced the bond, but his parents kept him out of jail. They paid back the people $100,000 for what was taken. That's pretty extraordinary. If he was supposed to get 35 months, he was sentenced to 2 months in a juvenile rehab facility. And I think that was a pivotal moment. There was a sense there that his parents would do anything to protect him.
His father, Joe Kelly, is a strong, brooding man who grew up in a poor Irish family.
He ran a plumbing business that he started from the ground up and made into a very successful, profitable business in town, very well liked by his customers.
In the 1960s, when they were both in their early 20s, Joe Kelly married Melanie Reisdorf. She was an active member of the Darien Junior League and ran a local travel agency.
There was money in her family, so Alex had a trust fund in excess of $500,000, I believe.
Throughout the spring, stories about the accusations of rape and Alex's past record of burglaries are splashed all over the Connecticut papers.
The media had a field day with Alex Kelly's case. It was just a great story for them. Rich kid goes bad. He wasn't doing well in Darien. There was always an Alex story in the papers. There was one particular incident where he was attacked by people at a restaurant.
Sherman asks the court to allow Alex to take a job in Colorado until the trial starts the following year.
We all thought it was a good idea to have him get out of town, where he would not be the lightning rod for controversy.
Late in the fall, Alex moves to Leadville, Colorado, not far from Aspen. He rents an apartment, gets a job at a local fast food restaurant, and spends most of his free time on the slopes. Meanwhile, back in Connecticut, the legal wrangling over his trial intensifies.
It was decided to combine the two cases. I think there was great sensitivity on the prosecutor's office that they want this nightmare over with for the two girls. They wanted these young women to be able to tell their stories and put this behind them.
Combining the trials was unquestionably a real serious legal setback.
His family really felt that this would seal his fate, that it was inherently unfair and unjust, and they protested mightily.
In 1987, 1 year after Adrian Back and Hillary Tollett accused Alex Kelly of sexual assault, Joe and Melanie Kelly join their son for a ski vacation in Colorado. Sherman meets with the family at their Aspen condo on February 12th to plan their legal strategy.
We're coming up very close to the trial, and I told Alex on several occasions, but it's just not getting a fair shake. That was clearly something that scared the hell out of them.
A few days before the trial starts, Joe Kelly goes back to Darien. Melanie hugs her son very emotionally at an airport and is seen doing that, and then she flies back.
He said he was going to pack up his stuff and was going to say goodbye to his friends and catch a later flight.
Joe and Melanie Kelly meet Sherman at the Stamford Courthouse on February 18th for jury selection.
Everybody went to court, and they're sitting in the courtroom. The prosecutor, they're all waiting to start jury selection, and there's no Alex. So they wait, and there's no Alex. And finally, someone says, where's Alex?
He's gone. He's gone. Where was he? Nobody knew. What was he capable of? I have no idea.
Alex Kelly vanished without a trace. Of course, it was all over the media that he had disappeared. Melanie and Joe's response was that they didn't know where he was. They had nothing to do with him leaving. Leave us alone.
I, of course, had told him that it's in his best interest to be here, that it's only making it worse because the charges will be increased, both state and federally.
Now what? Now what? I had just spent 6 months preparing for this day, this opportunity to get in front of my rapist and tell everybody what he did to me. And now it's gone.
Darien police immediately spring into action. First, they attempt to trace flight records.
He was on Continental Airlines, and they lost their records for that day. This was the early days of computers. There was a computer glitch.
Nobody could find him. And of course, the assumption was, here he is. He's just turned 19. He's a kid from the suburbs of Darien, Connecticut. So the thought was he had to be in the States.
Authorities check with his employer in Colorado. Alex has already picked up his final paycheck. They enlist the help of the National Crime Information Center in case he's arrested in another jurisdiction.
The FBI got involved in a case in 1987 after they issued an unlawful flight to avoid prosecution warrant.
The case just generated enormous publicity. After Alex disappeared, it really became a national story.
How long could this go on, right? Maybe a month or two. You have no idea.
We were constantly trying to figure out where he could have gone, how can we find him.
And whenever they went to the Kellys and they tried to talk to the Kellys, they stonewalled. And they would keep insisting that they had never heard from Alex, not a peep.
Leave us alone. That was their response.
Adrian's family kept the pressure up to keep looking for him. She wanted her day in court. The weeks went by, and the governor put forward a bounty. He offered $20,000 reward for any information leading to Alex's return.
I think we all figured at some point he would make a mistake and get caught somewhere. One way or the other, we would get him back. It's just a matter of how long it would be.
4 years later, Alex Kelly is still on the run.
I never knew where he was. I didn't know if he still wanted revenge. I always had that fear. He told me not to tell. I told everyone.
These two girls who had been attacked were essentially living with fear. Fear that he was on the loose. Fear that he could return to Darien at any time and maybe perhaps try to silence them.
This felt like I carried a 20-pound weight around with me in my stomach everywhere I went. Graduating from high school, going to college, and I was so tired of carrying this around.
As the years pass, authorities continue to hunt for Alex Kelly. In 1994, the FBI assigns a new agent to the case, Ralph DeFonso.
After we formed a task force in the state of Connecticut, we were looking at old cases of fugitives that hadn't been caught. Alex Kelly was on the top of that list.
The FBI and certainly Adrian's family began to suspect that he had to be having help because he was too young to just mastermind this all by himself.
In May, more than 8 years after the alleged attacks, DeFonso turns up the pressure on the Kelly family.
We figured, let's shake some people up.
He had to be getting money and most likely getting help from his mother, who worked for a travel agency. So finally, the FBI was able to get a warrant to search the Kelly home.
And they showed up there at 5 a.m. with a team of people.
They found money transfers, and they discovered that the Kelly family had been supporting him, which was quite incredible, really.
I don't think we were in that house. I know it wasn't less than an hour. One of the guys came down and said, hey, listen to what I found in this purse.
In her bag was an unposted letter that she hadn't had time to stick in the mail yet. And it was to this Elizabeth Johnson in Sweden. And when they opened it and they read the letter, they were able to see that Alex had most likely been living with her, that this was his Swedish girlfriend.
So they basically knew where to find Alex.
They contacted Swedish authorities, and the Swedish authorities moved to apprehend Alex.
When officials arrive at Elizabeth's home on a remote island off the Swedish coast, Alex Kelly has already left.
He was not there when they got there. He was gone.
Elizabeth tells authorities she hasn't seen Alex for at least a month. They have temporarily put their relationship on hold. Alex appears to be one step ahead of law enforcement. Was he tipped off?
It was extraordinary that a kid from the suburbs of Darien could elude the FBI and Interpol for 8 years. You expect that from Jason Bourne, but not from somebody from Darien.
When the FBI raids Joe and Melanie Kelly's home, they uncover a paper trail they hope will help them track down Alex Kelly.
The parents would no longer be able to send him money. They were also facing possible prosecution themselves for aiding and abetting Alex in avoiding his trial.
As investigators unravel the clues, it becomes clear that the young man from Connecticut has been on an extensive worldwide adventure, touring 15 countries in the past 8 years.
His favorite places to go were the playgrounds of the rich and famous. He liked the ski resorts of Europe, and he would go there and spend months there.
He was just like a young playboy, and he was just traveling, making the best of life.
Photographs confiscated from the Kelly home indicate that Alex's parents joined him for at least one ski vacation during those years. Around 1990, Alex meets 28-year-old Elisabeth Jansson from Klädesholm in Sweden.
He met her on a skiing trip, and presumably they had a whirlwind romance, and he moved in with her and just sort of disappeared into this tiny little community.
It's unbelievable that somebody could be in Europe and travel around between borders, have his parents come to see him, and that the authorities in a wealthy community, presumably aided by the authorities in Washington, could not find him.
Six months after the FBI raided his parents' home, Alex Kelly, now 27, makes a truly unexpected move. He surrenders to police in Zurich, Switzerland.
His parents were no longer able to fund his lifestyle, so he was about to run out of money. So he knew at that point that the game was up.
And he flew back to Connecticut in chains and handcuffs,
Alex steps off the plane, and it literally was like time had stood still. Everybody else had gotten older, grayer, sort of chubbier, and he walked off that plane, and he looked exactly the same. And he looked like he was stepping out of a Ralph Lauren catalog.
It was pretty dramatic. The reporters were all pretty excited to see him, and he looked kind of dazed.
He lived an 8-year vacation without any justice for his victims. These two young girls, they were 16 and 17 years old when this happened.
Hillary and Adrian wanted to see justice done. They wanted their rapist to be prosecuted.
Once again, Alex Kelly pleads not guilty to the two rape charges. Standing outside the courthouse with Melanie and Joe Kelly behind him, Alex's new lawyer, Thomas Puccio, a prominent New York litigator, says that the two girls, now women in their mid-20s, are not telling the truth. He insists Alex Kelly is innocent.
Are they lying?
I'm not going to try the case. Yes, they are. I'm not going to try the case right here, but I think you'll see when these allegations are scrutinized under cross-examination that they'll fly away.
I've waited 10 years, and my life has been defined by this rapist. And he's still acting like this didn't happen.
At first, authorities consider charging Joe and Melanie Kelly with aiding and abetting a fugitive.
They crossed the line. They went too far, perhaps, in enabling him to flee and then funding all of his years on the lam.
They were not charged with assisting the getaway or accessory after the fact.
And they figured that it wasn't desirable to have a family being prosecuted for, you know, helping their children.
It was a strategic move so as not to diffuse the sympathy or the anger against Alex, or allow the sympathy for the family to bleed onto the question as to whether or not Alex was guilty.
Remarkably, Alex is let out on bail.
He, surprisingly enough, was immediately put in the care of his parents. They were in charge of monitoring him, which is kind of shocking given the fact that he was on the lam for so long.
We're all thinking, is he gonna stick around? Are they gonna be able to keep him here? What's gonna happen next?
Alex Kelly's trial begins on October 15, 1996. In a major victory for his defense, Alex will now face two separate trials with two different juries. Neither jury will hear anything about the other rape allegation.
Hillary and Adrian were absolutely ready to go to trial and see that process through.
Adrian Back's case goes first. There is no forensic evidence against Alex, so it's only Adrian's word against his. And Alex Kelly continues to swear that he did not rape Adrian Back or Hillary Tollett.
I did not rape anyone. I did not commit these crimes. No.
My immediate reaction in seeing his response to that question was, he is such a bad liar.
Alex Kelly pleads not guilty.
I know that they're going to find me innocent, because I am.
On the first day of the trial, Adrian Back takes the stand.
I would say I was ready at that point. I wasn't fearful of him anymore as much as I was fearful of not being believed. And it's his word against mine. I remember seeing him for the first time. He never made eye contact with me. The entire time I was on that stand for a day and a half, he never once looked at me.
She testified that he choked her, he pinned her down, she couldn't move, she was terrified for her life, and then he lowered the back seat and forced her into it.
It's very hard in a room of hundreds of people telling the intimate details about what somebody did to you in your most vulnerable moment. It's terrifying.
defense attorney Puccio calls into question minute discrepancies in her story.
He asked her, did Alex always have his hand around your neck? And I think she said, always.
And he said, well, if you were pinned down and you couldn't move, how did he free his hands to lower the back seat? And he showed that it would require both hands to do it.
So they were suggesting that she lied.
On November 8th, 1996, the jury begins deliberations. After 3 days, the jury delivers a note to the judge. They are unable to reach a unanimous verdict. The judge announces a mistrial.
I failed. My biggest fear just came true. Someone on that jury didn't believe me. So I was devastated. And I kept thinking, I can't do this again. I don't think I can do this again. How am I going to do this again?
Six months later, the retrial begins.
Adrian knew what was coming from Puccio's cross-examination. And she knew that Puccio was going to fixate yet again on the issue of how the backseat went down.
I think at one point he said something like, well, when you were having sex with Alex Kelly in the back of the truck, and I stopped him and said, your client raped me. There's no confusion. Absolutely none. And I wanted to make sure that there's no doubt about what happened to me.
This time, the jury deliberates for just a few hours.
When they said guilty, I just felt a sense of relief. They finally believed me.
I think Alex was fully expecting another mistrial because he looked astonished.
The guilty verdict helped a lot. It certainly made it feel like I had gotten justice for what he had done to me. Hillary had done the hard part that night that it had happened to her when she was raped in 1986, and now it was sort of my turn, and I finally succeeded in doing my part.
Alex Kelly is sentenced to the maximum penalty, 20 years in state prison.
Will you be afraid tonight?
Not tonight, for the first time in a long time.
Adrian Back has been vindicated in every sense of the word.
In December 1998, Kelly pleads no contest to the rape of Hillary Tollett. He is sentenced to 10 years to be served concurrently with his sentence for the rape of Adrian Back.
11 years to bring him to justice. It was an incredible journey for her, and very few people would have had the courage to see that odyssey all the way through to the end.
On March 3rd, 2005, Alex Kelly appears at a parole hearing to plead for his early release.
I am not a risk to society anymore. I've been very motivated throughout my incarceration to do everything I can to change myself. I take full responsibility for the things I have done. I just want the people that I have victimized, and I know I'm not supposed to look at them, but I want them to know that I am sorry. And I honestly mean that.
For many years upon your incarceration, you denied this offense.
Well, I denied it to other people, but I always accepted it to myself. And I have tried to show that I am sorry.
Next, Hillary Tollett makes her statement to the parole board.
For 19 years, Adrian and I have been trying to get justice for the brutal rapes this man committed against us. That mere words will certainly fail to convey the pain he has caused. I was a child. This absolutely brutal, surreal experience has followed me for more than half of my life. I do not believe that being in prison for less time than he was vacationing in Europe is sufficient enough punishment. Please allow Adrian and I to have the justice we deserve by having him finish his sentence.
After hearing from both sides, the parole board renders its decision.
Mr. Kelly, by unanimous vote, the board has voted to deny your application for parole and set no new hearing date.
You see, so there's no more parole hearings?
There's no more parole consideration. There'll be no new hearing date set.
I would like to say something real fast.
Mr. Kelly, this hearing is concluded. Thank you.
Why did we come here? What? This was a waste
of time. Mr. Kelly, this hearing has been concluded.
In 2007, Alex Kelly is released after serving 10 years in prison. He currently lives and works in Connecticut.
He's been out for almost a decade now. He's not on parole anymore. He can pretty much just do what he wants. But for the rest of his life, he has to register as a sex offender. This is a rapist, a serial rapist, you know, really dangerous serial rapist who just happened to be good looking from a wealthy family in a high-end town in Connecticut.
It took me, at least 15, almost 20 years for me to forgive myself. Forgive myself for getting in the car. Forgive myself for not reporting it right away. Forgive myself for blaming myself for having this happen to me. The one thing I finally forgave myself for was Hillary. And that was really when I felt like I was over this. When I forgave myself for what happened to her.
Hillary Tollett has moved from Connecticut and now has a teenage daughter. She has not spoken publicly about the case for more than 10 years.
Rape is a crime of violence. It's not a crime of passion. It's not because we did anything wrong. It's not because of the choices that we made that night. It wasn't my fault. And it's not your fault if this happens to you. And it's nothing to be ashamed of. And if less women are ashamed, more women will come forward. And maybe I'll have something to do with that.